Welcome, welcome, welcome to Smart Talk. We're back on the air again. Today we have a dynamite show for you, and we got two things that seem very different. And actually, they are very different, and so I'm kind of glad we can do that. The first thing is we're going to talk about Iran and the United States. It's in the news all the time, the rivalry, the Gulf of Hormuz, and we have two experts on Iranian culture, society, and politics. And what we're going to do today is talk a little about Iran, the place, Iranians, the people, so we get some backdrop information about Iran that isn't just things we hear on the news, or they aren't just an empty category. It's not to ignore the geopolitics, and we'll talk some about that too, but it is to feed in some of the backdrop information. Our first guest, Layla Hudson, is Associate Professor in the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies here at the U of A. She received her Ph.D. degree in Anthropology and History at the University of Michigan. Our second expert is Kamran Tadaloff, who is also a professor in the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies. He, too, received his Ph.D. at the University of Michigan. Did you guys know each other?
From a distance.
From a distance. All right, all right. He's taught courses on classical and modern Persian literature, Iranian cinema, Iranian history, Persian language, and Middle Eastern women's writings. And finally, on our different topic, we have Kelsey Dale John, who's a postdoc research associate in the Department of American Indian Studies at the University of Arizona. She received her Ph.D. from Syracuse University. Her doctoral dissertation focused on the Navajo horse as a central point of indigenous decolonization and her research on res ponies. I love that phrase. Did you make that up?
No.
I love it. Res,
you know, common.
On the res and res ponies. It's a great title. Led her to organize a horse knowledge conference hosted by the Navajo Tribal University. It's fascinating. She is going to be talking to you about the downtown lecture series that she is giving. Her talk on October 24th at the Fox Theater. It's free, folks. You don't even need a ticket. First come, first serve. It's a large theater. They usually show movies and all kinds of other entertainment. But the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences has been putting on lectures down there. They've all been free. The first one was about the dog, the thinking dog. And now we're on the thinking horse. The title of her speech, Kelsey's talk, is The Navajo Horse as Healer and Educator. So we're going to jump back and forth between the two of them. Both of them are here in the studio with me. Layla's on the phone. And Layla, this includes you too. Of course, you're just listening in. If anyone has any question about the other topics, please join in so we can make this a conversation. And of course, for you folks out there, 790-2040. That's our call-in number. Give us a call, express an opinion, ask a question. Come on, let me start with you, and let's start with Iran. If you were asked, and maybe you have been, when you speak to public groups, what is the one thing that Americans don't know about Iran that might be helpful for our understanding of what's behind the American-Iranian tension in the Middle East?
Well, that Iran is not a unified, homogeneous country. I can simplify this concept by saying that there are three different groups in Iran. The majority of people are democracy lover, pro-Western. They want the same lifestyle as we do here. They aspire democracy and liberty. And they have historically been known as lover of American liberalism. You might be surprised to know that very often, even unpopular American presidents polled very highly in Iran, including President George Bush, whose ratings was very low in Europe, but he was nearly 99% in Iran. Of course, partly having to do with removing Saddam, who had attacked Iran for 8 years. Then there is the government, which is very a small minority, very powerful, but anti-American, anti-Western, with their own aspiration and making religion as a state ideology.
Let me jump in with a quick question. Iran is a democracy?
It's not a democracy. It's autocracy, but it's not a. It's a multi-voice autocracy. There are different factions within that government, and I just to finish that mapping. There is a segment of society that is between liberal-seeking, democracy-seeking, mass population, and that minority that is ruling the country.
And there's a third group, wasn't there?
Well, yes, this is the third group, which is usually folks that want to be within the power, but like to... reform the country, like to reform the culture and society and so on and so forth. So they are kind of in, out of the power on a constant basis.
Leila, you're listening in here too. And other than those three sort of political demographics, could you add something else that Americans may not know about Iran?
Well, I just want to echo my colleague Kamran's point that when Americans think of Iran, they need to think of a rich, ancient culture that shares more values at the popular level with the United States than its government in any way represents. So rather than thinking of Iran always as the hostile foreign power that it appears as in international relations, you also have to think of the human and cultural side. 80 million people strong, many of whom share most liberal and international values.
So this is, of course, you guys can probably guess where I'm going to go next, and the audience is thinking the same thing. On the one hand, the two experts say America-loving, liberal-loving, Western-loving, it's three-quarters of the people. B, dealing with the tensions between the United States and Iran, the great Satan phrase from the past, how do we get most of the folks wanting it one way and the policies of the country being another way? In a nutshell, twixt cup and lip, what's happened? Either of you, jump in.
Well, let me just say, again, clearly, since the 1979 Iranian Islamic Revolution, the government shifted 180 degrees from being America's staunchest ally in the region to being, the Iran that we all are familiar with today. One important dynamic to note is that to the extent that the United States as it's doing in this moment, puts a lot of pressure on Iran without following through effectively, mm-hmm. that consolidates the government's power, okay? And I'll leave that open as a point for discussion, that, again, the current moment that we're in right now of withdrawing from the nuclear, unilaterally withdrawing from the nuclear agreement with Iran, and pushing us closer to open conflict with Iran without great strategy on our side, if you're an Iranian citizen, that allows you to consolidate more than you would otherwise with your much resented government.
Gotcha. So let's take a step back for both of you. So if we were to do the biggest possible picture, what is the framing geopolitics, or what are the framing issues? Is it differences within Islam, Shia, Iran, and parts of Lebanon and other parts versus Sunni Saudi Arabia and the larger Arab world? Is it a religious thing that the United States is tied into? Is it just oil? Is it client statism that the Americans fear Iran and Russia? What is the thing that's led to the specifics of the history you're describing? I get that. Why are we in this thing?
All of those things are elements, but at the heart of it is the geopolitics around the world's oil supply. And our topic today, the Strait of Hormuz, where something like 20% of the world's oil supply passes through this tiny little narrow strait. That's geography. That doesn't change. That's not going anywhere. So if we're looking for foundational
who controls the strait?
Issues,
Kamran wants to jump in for a second.
The strait per se, but let me let Kamran jump in. But the geography that involves oil, water, cargo, movement, and hostile states, that is a permanent fixture of the landscape by definition.
Okay, come on.
As Leila said, all of these elements are important. But there's one additional factor, and that is that the division in contemporary Islam, to be honest, I believe this religion is in crisis. Since the late 50s, there has been two different major factions within Islamic politics. One is more liberal, one is more fundamentalist. And then that political divisions include both Shiites and Sunnis. So in some of these places, these fundamentalist groups were able to gain power and run a country, and that would be including Iran. And that brought a huge difference in the way culture is produced, culture is consumed, relationship with the West in Iran. So people all of a sudden found themselves from a relatively secular society into a really
much
highly religious
right. Society. We're going to take a break here, and we're going to be right back, and we're going to switch to Kelsey, and we're going to talk about the Navajo horse as healer and educator and what the horse can teach you. Stick with us. We're back. Our next guest is Kelsey Dale John, who's giving the talk down at the Fox Theater, October 24th, the Navajo horse as healer and educator. She's here with us today. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi.
And she's going to talk about what she's going to talk about. So let's cut to the chase, as they sometimes say. How is the horse, or the Navajo horse for the Navajo, or could horse be for all of us, how is it a healer and an educator?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a huge question. I think the first thing that I would say is to just start with, you know, I'm a doctor, right? I did my whole PhD. And as I was going through that process, I was always questioning, you know, what does it mean to be educated? What does that mean? And so I always would kind of think back to early forms of education, things outside of formal schooling, where I learned a lot that translated everywhere. And so that was looking back at my relationship with horses my whole life, and looking at trainers and family members who are riding horses, and thinking about all of the lessons that I learned through that system of care. So I always say, like, I knew how to ride a horse and feed a horse and saddle a horse and work with a horse before I even went to school. And so it really is, it's a form of education. And in the Navajo way, and a lot of other cultures, we say that horses are healers. And so not only, you know, physically, but also emotionally and spiritually. So there's a lot that you get from that bond with horses, that time spent with them. It's kind of something that's almost metaphysical or spiritual. It's hard to put into words. But that interaction, I often describe it as a dance when you're working with a horse.
Can you give me an example or a short story or something that happened to you to kind of ground this idea?
Yeah. I think one of the coolest things is the riding relationship is obviously one way that you can relate to horses. But I had this horse that I was riding, and we sort of knew each other, you know, kind of like human interaction, right? You're feeling each other out. It's like a conversation between two very different but similar entities. And so I was riding this horse. It was actually on the Navajo reservation with my parents, and we were all riding together. And there was a really steep incline that we needed to go up. And it was one of those inclines where you sort of felt like you're going to slide backwards off the horse. And I was thinking, you know, can my horse do it? Like, can we do this? And we did it. We got up this hill, we got through it together, and I didn't fall off backwards. And so when you have that moment of like fear and then getting through something together, it really bonds you in a different kind of way. It's almost like you realize the horse has your back, and they realize that you have their back as well.
You know, you mentioned in the blurb about the talk you're going to give, as the Navajo horse as a central point of indigenous decolonization. So would you mind decoding the phrase indigenous decolonization? Put it in kind of ordinary words. Thanks.
For sure. I think the best way I would describe this is that it goes back to education. So before formal schooling was introduced into American Indian communities, we had our own education systems. And that was basically us spending time with the land and with the livestock and with our families. So before boarding schools came into the picture, we were at home with our clan groups and our families, and we had ranches, we had agriculture, we had this whole system of knowing and of education that was passed on through family relationships, known as the clanship system. And so what happened is that during the colonization of the U.S., and I'm speaking more specifically here about U.S. and Navajo, is that different institutions came in, like boarding schools, like churches, like different land management systems that were not traditional or indigenous to Navajo and other Native American societies. And so it really changes the way that you relate to the land. It changes the way that you relate to one another. And I actually think this really goes back to our conversation on Iran, right? And looking at how culture and gender and religion, they're all important in how it is that you see the outside world or relate to, you know, other nations as well. And that's the same thing with Navajo. We're a sovereign nation. And so we have systems and ways of knowing. And so what decolonization means is it really means that we're going back to those original forms of knowing, or we're trying to figure out how we can manifest them now that we've had all these changes and these interruptions and even, you know, violences in our community. And so my project is looking at how horse education and our traditional horse knowledge that we've had for thousands of years can be something that works into tribal universities or K through 12 education. How can we get students working with horses, or, you know, have people thinking about how to relate to animals and how to relate to land and what it is that we learn from that beyond, you know, simply just riding your horse, but what it tells us about how to be in the world.
You know, the question that might be coming next is, it must be a balance between fitting in and being good at the world around the reservation, the United States, work, everything else, and at the same time being in touch with roots such that you don't lose where you came from and get lost. How is that balance?
Yeah, I think it's a delicate balance, but it's an important balance, and it's something that natives are so good at. You know, we maintain our traditions and our culture in very unique ways that continue to help us participate in kind of two worlds. A lot of people call it walking in two worlds. You just learn to not only translate things linguistically, but to translate ways of thinking. So you sort of move from one way of seeing the world and thinking, and you move into another, but that back and forth, that becomes the dance. That's very similar to working with horses. It can be, I think everything can go into a metaphor of working with horses. You know, you're in the corral. My horse's name is Bambi, and I've been training her. And so I move into the corral, and we work together. We perceive one another. We move back and forth. But, you know, I'm not with her all day long. We don't work together. We don't, you know, that's not my job. I'm a professor, but I move in and out of those worlds, and I translate how my thinking with Bambi in the corral is actually really me thinking about indigeneity or land issues or even gender issues for Native American people, or how to create better education systems. So it's that dance, and a lot of people frame it as something negative, but I think it's actually something very beautiful.
Sort of reminds you of, and Colin, jump in this too, what we call ethnic communities in America. You think of the classic movies about New York and the Italian family or the Jewish family or the Irish, getting in touch with those kind of roots, coming to America and going through a series of stages of assimilation, being part of the system. Yet at the same time, it's sort of like the first generation wants to, quote, pass or, you know, show America. And then once sort of in, one feels that one needs to tie up with those base. Does that ring a bell, Kamran, for you?
Yeah. I actually have a question that it's incredible the way you describe the relationship between you and Bambi. I wonder how often do you get to see her, and then once you see her, what is the reaction? Because I cannot imagine it pictured for myself. You know?
Yeah, so she actually just came down here this weekend. My parents trailered her down here. So
I hope she's listening on the. I hope we have a radio in the trailer. She can hear.
She'd probably have some criticisms, honestly. So she, she's here with me now in Tucson, and I adopted her from an equine rescue, actually.
Oh.
So Bambi is what you could call, there's a lot of debate around this, but a wild horse off the Navajo reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was picked up with a herd of horses that got onto the highway. And she ended up at a place called Four Corners Equine Rescue, which is in Aztec, New Mexico. It's a wonderful rescue that takes in a lot of Navajo, you know, free range horses. And their mission is to work with them and find them homes. So that's how I started to be with her. So I would work with her, you know, 3-4 times a week. And then when I adopted her, I get to see her every day now. And so she was with my parents for a short time while I transitioned to Tucson, but now she's here with me. So our reaction when we see each other, it's funny because, you know, a horse, like a human, like I always say, you know, Bambi is my favorite non-human human, because our interactions are very similar to how humans interact to one another. So, you know, when she sees me, she might be excited. She kind of likes to like cuddle. She likes to stick her nose into my tummy when she's happy, but she also gets frustrated with me too. And so when there's been a long time that I haven't been able to see her or work with her, she's sort of indifferent to me, but it's like a purposeful indifference of like, I haven't seen you and you haven't been here and I'm going to kind of look at you from the side and not...
Where have you been?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating. We had earlier from the U of A also, Sally Morrison, a professor of geography, talking about the Tucson Garden Project. And they had found having the kids out in elementary school working in a garden did similar kinds of things. Has your work and your participation in this outreach with the Navajo community resulted in not introducing the horse to the classroom, but is there any practical things that are now being carried on from what you've been studying?
So the biggest thing that I've been working on is this public horse conference, and it's hosted on Navajo Nation at one of our tribal universities. It's called Navajo Technical University. And with that, I bring in a live horse and a trainer. So we do like a live training demonstration. And that's awesome because we physically have the horse on campus. We've got students and faculty, you know, gathered around watching whatever trainer, whoever comes in, work with the horse and then explain, you know, I'm doing this movement. I'm adjusting my attitude in this way, right? I'm controlling my emotion. I'm doing this technique. But then it also... They'll translate that back into what that means for education as well, too. You know, what it means for research, too, right? Like, that's another big part of it. So, yeah, I think that's sort of my biggest translation project now is how do we create spaces in which people can actually engage with horses as a form of education.
Do you ever get pushback from teenagers? Like, why do I need a goddamn horse? Why don't we have a... Why don't you teach me how to ride a motorcycle? Or why don't you teach me how to deal with a car?
You know, I don't think I've really had pushback like that because most of the communities that I've worked with have been Navajo, and it's just understood, right? It's a symbol of who we are and our culture. And so even if people maybe don't have a horse or they're not super into riding, there's that level of respect of like, oh, this is something that's like really foundational to who we are as Navajos. And so there's got to be that respect for it.
You know, you think
Al,
about...
Can I just jump in here?
Yeah, please.
Listening to this...
You got to be quick for just a few seconds. We're going to take a break.
But it's such a highlight, the difference between the intimate relational politics of engagement that you're talking about versus the extractive geopolitics of the Iran situation. You know, I think it's great that we're talking about these things in the same frame so we can bring out the interesting contrast.
I think that's a great idea, and here's what we're going to do. Folks, we're going to take a break right now, and then when we come back, Leah Hudson, professor at the University of Arizona, is going to talk about the horse and Iranian politics and what we can learn from both. Stay with us. Smart Talk with Al Bergeson, 790-2040 is the number to call in and get on the air and talk with our guests. today, which include Leah Hudson from the School of Middle Eastern and North African Studies, and also her colleague, Kamran Tadaloff, and Kelsey Dale Don from the Kelsey Dale John, pardon me, I'm reading this way too quick, from the Department of American Indian Studies at the U of A, talking about her forthcoming talk as part of the SBS Downtown Lecture Series, The Navajo Horse, as healer and educator, and somehow mixing Iran and the horse will be Layla's homework assignment for after three minutes of commercials, and now she will give us a short talk. Layla, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, you know, when we look at Iran in the news today, you're seeing kind of a tectonic shift in the underlying geopolitics of the region. So, yes, the enmity between the United States and Iran goes back decades. But this is a very interesting moment right now. So we've seen repeated small confrontations, games of chicken, if you will, around the oil infrastructure and the movement through the Strait of Hormuz. Just in the last couple of months, there have been four or five little incidents. So you can see Iran testing the United States at this really interesting moment where everything is possibly changing. The long-standing U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia that stabilizes oil prices, that underlies the global economy, is shifting in pretty unpredictable ways. And you have only to look at the Trump administration right now and how this set of impeachment inquiry issues unfolding to see that it is deeply, deeply entwined with the new regime of Saudi Arabia.
So what do you think is going on? What do all these surface movements, I agree with you completely. What's going on? Is it that the Americans are moving with more concern with China and East Asia, and we're creating a void in the Middle East, and various outside powers are moving in?
Yes. And it goes, you know, this is a history that goes back beyond this particular precarious moment. Just suffice it to say that since World War II, the United States alliance with Saudi Arabia in terms of the structure of the world's oil system and the world's financial system has been pretty central to how everything operates. And the United States has been a dominant player in the region through that particular vehicle. If you go back to 2013, this precedes the Trump administration. The Obama administration failed to push through a red line in Syria, failed to push back against the deployment of chemical weapons in Syria by Iran's ally, the Assad regime, and in doing so, announced that the Middle East was open for shifts in those major geopolitical alignments.
So let's say that. Leila, we got to go back and forth here rather than just giving a lecture because we're on the radio. So let's think for a second. What's behind then Iran's moving in if the Americans are moving out?
Well, I mean, Iran is not going anywhere. Iran is where Iran is, and it is defending a strategic position.
But the support for support for Hezbollah and other groups, the Houthi rebels and stuff like that. What people talk about
of
that?
Of course. You've got Hezbollah allies in Lebanon. You've got a strong set of allies and paramilitaries and control within Iraq. You've got
the Syrian government.
The possibility of strong support. Yeah, the Syrian government. You've got the possibility of support for the Houthi rebels in Yemen. So Iran has a network of power projecting smaller alliances throughout the region. It's not going anywhere.
So let me jump in a second for both of you, guys, don't mind. Everything that we've said, I think, is true, and I think everyone agree because it's a nice description of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Let's think, what would you folks suggest as possible steps the United States should take to better deal with this situation? Let's think a little proactively.
Well, look, Iran has an agenda. has a strategy, has plans. After the 1979 revolution, this new regime in Iran doesn't have has had not a, a nationalist aspiration as the previous monarchy, the king, had in Iran. People remain nationalists. This regime has an international aspiration, and that would be the creation of an alliance between the Shiite forces in the region. And perhaps from there, creating a Shiite Marcus, for the lack of a better word. Now, they're very clear in what they want. However, the United States has never been clear about its policies, its plans in regard the Middle Eastern politics. Usually, we react to what happens in the Middle East. And that is the basic thing that has to be changed. And the new policy should not be only based on what Saudi Arabia wants from us or what Israel prefers. It should be more general. It should be taken into consideration everything that is going on historically, culturally, and religiously.
Leila, you want to jump in on that?
Now, that being said, the United States foreign policy is currently in chaos. There is no strategy, there is no sort of personnel and infrastructure in place to craft a nimble enough strategy to definitively solve some of these problems. So again, the Trump administration, we just saw chaos in the firing of John Bolton. So the United States unilaterally pulls out of the nuclear agreement, which, whether you like it or you think you could have a better agreement or what have you, was a channel for talking to and communicating with Iran. By unilaterally pulling out of it, that challenges Iran to push the boundaries of its nuclear developments and to assert territoriality and dominance, sometimes by mobilizing its network of regional allies.
And yes, I think that's absolutely so. Leila, let me just shift for a second and ask Kamram a question. You know, we initially talked about getting to know Iran better, and I know Iran has a rich history of movies, novels, particularly women authors in novels. So could you talk to us a little bit about a couple of books folks might want to read in literature, or an Iranian movie that's contemporary and really neat, so that people actually want to see what Iranians are watching or thinking or et cetera, they could do?
Yes, Iran has a rich culture, a very long history. Zoroastrianism was a very rich, very interesting religion and cultures in pre-Islamic period. So Iran has been touched by Islamic forces twice, once in 7th century when the Arab Muslims invaded the Persian Empire and toppled the Sasanian dynasty. And then in 1979 when contemporary Islamic forces and group led by Khomeini took over the revolution and toppled the rule of the last Pahlavi kings. Now, after the revolution, and despite all the limitations put by this new religious regime, it's very interesting that culture is still thriving, literature is thriving, cinema is thriving, and most importantly, women are thriving.
So is there a tension between a conservative regime and women novelists and feminism in Iran? What's the tension between a conservative regime and activist women?
Oh, yeah, there is. And perhaps maybe women have found more incentives in being active. You know, today, if you want to count the 10 best novelists in today's Iran, 8 of them are women. In terms of cinema, they're highly active, and some of the Iranian films, movies are winning awards internationally every year, almost every year. Novels have been translated into English. Collections of poetry are into English.
Your favorites?
My favorites are, you know, I've co-translated two novels by an author called Shahrnush Barzibu. One of them is called Women Without Men, and the other is Tuba, The Meaning of the Night. I thought that they're really reflective of what's going on in Iran in terms of gender dynamics, and that's why I translated them. There are poetry of Fruh Farrokhzad, although she lived before the revolution, but her poems are still highly relevant. Movies made by Kiarostami, a master movie maker, are all really interesting. The movie Separation won an Oscar recently made by Farhadi. These are all great.
Tell us again slowly, maybe even spell it out. What was the Oscar-winning movie, so folks might want to get it?
It was called The Separation.
The Separation.
Yes.
When did it come out? A few years ago?
And then it was 3 years ago. And then last year, another movie by the same director, by the name of The Salesman.
The Salesman.
Yeah, won another Oscar.
And a novel or two you'd suggest? Well, Leila, we'll get to you in a second.
I want to put in a pitch for Kamran's translation of the book Women Without Men, which Kamran translated. I often give that to my classes.
Okay.
And that's a very memorable title and a good insight into gender relations in Iran. So Women Without Men.
Is Women Without Men the idea of women's independence and don't need to be dependent on men? Is that what Women Without Men, or is it?
Well, people should read the book.
Yeah. what a great tease!
Actually, I heard that recently has been translated again because another publisher wanted to have that. There are a lot of good literature, and of course, you know that classic Persian literature is still very relevant. Rumi, the 13th century Persian poet, has been a bestseller for maybe four decades in the United States of America, and Rumi's poems have been translated by a number of different translators in modes. You know,
we've got to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to turn to Kelsey and ask her again about what you can learn and how you can be healed. That's Pickley, I want to know, by dealing with your horse. Stay with us. Ooh, we're back. I just got the signal from John. So we are back on the air. Kelsey, do you consider yourself a horse whisperer?
I don't think so. I don't know if anyone who calls themselves that would really be that.
Good for movies. Huh?
Yeah.
It was good for movies. But behind that, though, obviously, there was some, because the horse whisperer is in the same ballpark as your communication. And so what do you think they meant by a horse whisperer?
You know, I think that one of the most interesting things about horses is that they show us and teach us everything about relationships. And so I think that if you were to characterize a horse whisperer, it's simply someone who is an expert with relationships, and that means a bunch of different things. I think for a lot of indigenous communities and Navajos specifically, it means that not only your relationships with humans, but also with the land and with other animals. And the sort of underlying thing of that is that, you know, everything is alive. That's what we believe. Everything is like a being and is autonomous and has knowledge. And so in my work, I'm trying to position the horse as a knower and as a teacher and as an autonomous being. And I think that's sort of your step into what maybe we would characterize as a horse whisperer, is realizing that horses are smarter than you, they're stronger than you, and they have a perception that you don't necessarily have. So you're putting them in that space of respect and kind of elevating their positionality in the world. And I think that's what it means to be a horse whisperer. It doesn't mean that, you know, you dominate a horse or you break a horse or you force them to do what you want them to do.
Gotcha. You know, it's interesting. The first Downtown Lecture Series coming up this Thursday, October 3rd, with Evan McLean, who's talking about the thinking dog or the smart dog. And the dog research points out that dogs and humans have co-evolved for a long time, so that they pick up social cues that, say, a chimp who is technically smarter might not. So that you look to a corner and the dog will look to the corner. The chimp will go, why am I looking at a corner? It's stupid. There's nothing there, because he's not co-evolved. Do you think the horse co-evolving with humans back to Mongols or before and through the plains and stuff when the Spanish horses broke loose in New Mexico, or whatever the origin story of horses on the plains is, we've co-evolved together, and that's one of the reasons why we can communicate?
For sure. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that I always like to say is that, you know, Native nations here in the U.S., and Navajo in particular, horses have been with us the entire time. So we've been here since the beginning of time, and our horses have been with us. And so really, our creation narratives that sort of give us instructions for how to be in the world, not only they tell us where we're from, but they also tell us kind of where we're going and how we should be doing that. They have horses there the entire time. So that's sort of our story of co-evolution, right? Is that they're always here, we're in relationship with them, and we're meant to be in relationship with them. And I think that's really important. And it really brings me back to a lot of conversations that I think overlap with Layla and Cameron, which is that there's so much going on with land and geopolitics, right? And so I think that it's easy to look at my... what I say about horses is it's so fuzzy and it's fun and, you know, everyone loves horses, but it's actually deeply political. And it kind of reminds me of this very famous phrase in women's and gender studies, which is that the personal is political. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the different, you know, novels that Cameron is talking about, where it's women's perspectives about, you know, about gender and relationships and relationalities with men or religion, right? All of these things are also... they feed into and they connect to the geopolitics of the area in really complex ways. And so it's the same with horses. You know, Navajo Nation also has a very long history of resource extraction that has made a lot of changes in our community. And currently, you know, we're dealing with uranium mining cleanup from the uranium mining in that was basically used to fuel World War II and the Manhattan Project, that all that uranium was extracted from Navajo Nation. And so the politics of the area are not just the politics of the people in the area, but they're the politics of the land and the horses. And so if you don't understand those relationships from a Navajo perspective, from a pre-uranium mining perspective, then, you know, how are you going to get back to a place where all of these things can exist, you know, in peace and in a good way with each other? That's kind of where the horse is positioned.
That's such a beautiful template for how we need to approach regional geopolitics. So knowing the horse, knowing the land, knowing the people, say, by starting with tiny baby steps, say, by reading Kamran's translation or watching one of these award-winning Iranian movies, think about that the same way you try to build a relationship with the animals and the plants and the environment around you. And you're going to need that, because the infrastructures of politics and states and extractive capitalism put in place are leading us towards disaster. And whether you think of that as a regional war in the Middle East or something even larger involving climate change and planetary abuse, the only way back from that is to couch some of these mechanics of geopolitics based on oil in, you know, a much more intimate, a much more caring, a much more relational understanding of the people of the region, and even the ecosystems and the geology of the region.
Yeah, can I go?
And this is the challenge of our time, really.
Yeah, may I give you a more specific example of that, Leila? There is a group of Omanis who every year bring their horses for an event in Sonoita, Arizona. Mm. And of course, one of our students, you probably know her, Susan Day, is involved with that. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn that people, ordinary people in Sonata, know a lot about Amani's culture now because of that connection, because of
Amani?
That event. From Amman, yes.
Oh, yeah, thank you. No,
the country.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think
horse diplomacy is a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's horse pedagogy, right? Like, where else do you learn these things except in education systems? And I think that, you know, it dovetails into so many different conversations, but then there is this element of like love and care, and in a lot of ways it's a maybe what you would call a feminist project, right? And sort of assigning these ideas that are generally associated with women, right? Like care and love and relationality, but saying, you know, it's not just a biologically female thing, obviously. It's something that, you know, everyone does. And I think, you know, one of the best horse trainers that I have ever known is my dad. And he's a very kind of masculine, you know, manly guy, but he has this relationship with horses that is, it's loving and it's perceptive and it's spiritual. And that's what makes him such a good horse trainer. And then you see that sort of translate into all these other projects in his life. And I think that, you know, with my work, it's really positioning, like, why are we not asking the horse this question, right? Like, Navajo Nation has a lot of questions about what it means to decolonize, you know, how do we clean up, you know, uranium mining? How do we understand how to speak our language and still be successful in an English-speaking world? You know, how do we practice our traditional ways and live on the land and be close with the land, even though we might have to travel out for university or for school or for work? And I think that all of these really tough questions that are not just about culture, but they're about land and systems that we interact with, you know, why don't we ask horses that? And so the title of my dissertation is, what can the horse teach us about decolonizing education? And so my talk really this fall in October, it's a series of questions that I feel like Bambi asks me in our training relationship. And they're deep questions about, you know, decolonization and what is science and what is research and what does it mean to be educated, right? It's assuming that horses don't perceive and think about these things, I think is a big mistake on humans' parts, right? Like, it's kind of funny, but it's not. Yeah. If you spend time with horses, you realize they actually know what's going on.
You know, the horse thing cuts two ways, it seems to me. I'd like you guys and you too, Leah, discuss this. On the one hand, we've been doing the horse and feminism and things to learn. It's also the case, as I understand it, and help me here, that the Comanche were very good at the horse, but also for raiding, and really have been said to have been some of the best warriors on horseback since the Mongols, or even better. So there you have a horse pressed into service, you know, for war making, and as opposed to learning other kinds of other, I suppose, a healing. You have a horse pressed into service for death. Is there an analogous thing with a Navajo, or how do you put all that stuff together too? Anyone can answer this one.
Yeah, I mean, I love the phrase raiding because it reminds me of that picture after Hurricane Katrina where there's a white individual who's gathering supplies and the news article is, oh, they're gathering supplies for their family. And then there's a black individual who's gathering supplies and they're raiding a store. And so I always kind of push back on the word raiding because I think that it characterizes Native people in this sort of violent kind of way as like, you know, but there was so much going on pre-contact, you know, in the U.S. space of what it is now, of interactions between nations, right? And so I think that it could be protection, right? It could be survival. It could be gathering resources for your family and not necessarily raiding. But, you know, I do think that horses, as with anything, can be used as tools of colonialism too, right? Like some people have stories of the Spanish using their horses to conquer, and that's sort of that's a way in which they're used to sort of further a system of dominance or violence, right? But I think that's anything, right? Like education can be really
you can press it
great,
in, like
or
a hand can hold a pen, or a hand can hold a hammer,
right?
Okay, we got 3 minutes left, so here's what we're going to do: we got 3 minutes and three guests. So I'm going to ask each of you to take a minute and give your last thoughts on it. For Kamran and Leah, I would like to ask you, are you optimistic or pessimistic about American-Iranian relations?
I'm optimistic in long term. I think that something profoundly might be happening in Iran. I think that the situation is not sustainable anymore. And so long term, I'm optimistic. In the short term, I don't see any way out of the situation now.
Layla?
I agree with Kamran. I'm optimistic in the long term. I'm petrified about the short term, however. If we make it through, and again, we haven't really had time to explore this, if we make it through the current chaos of U.S. changing relationship in the Middle East, then of course, especially if we can learn from the horse and be more relational, more human, more attentive to the ecosystems, of course I'm optimistic in the long term.
That's a great summary statement. I should just repeat that at the end of the show. Kelsey?
I'm always optimistic, and I think the reason why is that, you know, when you spend so much time, as much time as I do with horses, you can't help but be optimistic. And I think, you know, there's also a healthy level of, like, pessimism that comes in and, you know, studying some of the systems of colonization that I do study, but then it's sort of to go back and to have that relationship and to know that there's the resource out there, right? And for us, it's like that the creator gave us this resource to learn and to know and to relate to. That keeps me optimistic.
I want to thank the three of you for coming in here. I'd never thought we could somehow mix Iran and geopolitics with a horse, but all three of you wonderfully warmed up to this topic and did really good. One quick advertisement. Kelsey will be giving a talk. Kelsey Dale John, the Navajo as horse and healer, an educator. Horse healer, the Navajo horse as
the
healer
Navajo
and
horse,
educator.
Yeah.
Boy, I'm getting tired at the October 24th at the Fox Theater, 17 West Congress, downtown in Tucson. I want to thank all you guys for coming in, and let's do it again sometime.
Yeah.
Al Bergeson for Smart Talk. See you all next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.